So, Angela, you know, Christmas is coming up, and I've got you an assorted set of combs for your hair.
That I just cut off.
Oh, my Lord, you've cut your hair off.
How are we going to do this?
You're supposed to then say, I got you this chain for your pocket watch.
So I got you this chain for your pocket watch.
Oh no, I've sold my pocket watch to afford these combs. Remember you cut your hair?
Yeah, I remember.
Okay, well, there's a weird tie-in with the gift of the Magi.
Are you really going to go with that?
Yeah. Why not? That's a decent enough intro. People are confused. It's a Christmas story. Gift of the Magi is one of the more famous Christmas short stories out there, right?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of other short Christmas stories, though. But
and who wrote the Gift of the Magi?
O. Henry.
So should we get into it? Should we talk about the connection?
Sure.
O. Henry, the author of Gift of the Magi, was in the pokey with our subject today.
Mr. Al Jennings.
Mr. Al Jennings. The pokey, the clink, the big house. Jail.
Thanks.
Prison. Got any others?
I don't. You just took all the good ones.
Yeah. So Al Jennings, that's our subject. This is our first in a series of Oklahoma outlaw episodes.
So did you realize how many outlaws are associated with Oklahoma?
Yeah, there were quite a bit. I mean, I don't know a whole lot of them. I know, you know, Pretty Boy Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
You were just telling me about the Daltons.
The Dalton gang and the Dalton Doolin gang, which were the Wild Bunch.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I think, you know, a lot of people have heard of the Wild Bunch, and that's an actual Oklahoma association. So it's kind of fun. And, well, the Bell Star.
Yeah, I knew that. Yeah. Bell Star.
Mm-hmm.
Bell Star, supposedly, her last dance was with Frank Eaton, also known as Pistol Pete.
Before she was murdered?
Yes.
All right. That's what I thought. So why do you think Oklahoma was so attractive to outlaws?
I think mainly, especially after the Civil War, the tribal governments were in ruin. I mean, they had their light horse brigades that were kind of like the mounted police units, but they could only cover so much. There was just a lack of infrastructure and law.
Right. So, well, and
the federal government didn't have real jurisdiction.
Right. There wasn't even a court anywhere around except for Fort Smith, I think.
Yeah. And that's where you get Judge Isaac Parker and the hanging judge there was 161 death sentences and 79 of those were carried out.
I have in 21 years, Parker tried more than 13,000 cases. 156 men and 4 women were sentenced to death by hanging, and 77 were actually hung.
What they would do is he would deputize these people. They'd build up posses to go into Indian territory and bring out fugitives. And that's where you get this, you know, the lawmen, you know, your Bass Reeves and your real famous deputies are the ones that would go out.
Marshals that would go out and go bounty hunting or whatnot.
Well, not so much the marshals, but the deputies were the ones who did the work.
And that's what,
Buddy talks about that a little later, how the marshal was more of a clerical job, but it was the deputy who actually went out.
So it's weird because they portray the marshal in TV shows and movies.
Yeah, I mean, he talks about a marshal. It's because a lot of times the marshal is the one who wrote the book. Another outlaw tale is kind of the during the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl, and this is where you get your Pretty Boy Floyd. You know, you get your story of the man hard on his luck who feels like the bankers took the farm. A decent man can't get it done anymore. So
right. So kind of like a Robin Hood story.
Yeah. Somebody robbing the rich to give to the poor. Well, like we said, today we're talking about the Gift of the Magi. No. We're talking about...
What?
No, today, you know, we're talking about Al Jennings. So you actually had a great contact for the go-to guy in the city to talk about Al Jennings.
Yeah, Betty Johnson, he works for the Metropolitan Library System, and he wrote a book on the subject about Oklahoma outlaws, so we might actually have him in a couple of times to talk more about these different outlaws, because there's so many, and there's a lot of stories. Yeah, I find them fascinating. I don't know about you, but I think it's just kind of fun.
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely outlaws are, that's part of the Wild Wild West, right? Well, Buddy, thanks for being here. Can you introduce yourself to everyone?
Yeah, sure. I'm Buddy Johnson. My title is Special Collections Manager at the Metropolitan Library System. Basically, I'm a local historian, so I've been doing that for about 20 years for the system.
So what got you interested in history?
I mean, I've always been interested in history from when I was a kid. And then I was actually a European history major in college. And I grew up in Tulsa. And when you grow up in Tulsa, at least in my era, you never, like, I'd never heard of the land run. I never heard of any of the stuff that happened in Oklahoma Territory. It was all Indian Territory, Trail of Tears, you know, the Five Tribes, all that kind of stuff. I don't know if it's still that way or not. But so when I moved here in the 80s, all the Oklahoma City stuff was brand new to me. And so I really kind of dove into that and, you know, tried to learn a whole new history of the area I was from. So just when I started for the library system, it was just kind of a niche that hadn't been filled by anybody. And so I just kind of jumped into it and kind of carved out my own career there. So,
yeah. So you're an author as well, correct? Yep. What subjects have you written on?
Most of the published stuff has been local history. I did write one photo essay book about Harry Truman, but other than that, they've all been local Oklahoma City or Oklahoma materials. I wrote probably the one I love the most. I wrote an annotated edition of And Satan Came Also, which is kind of the classic history of Oklahoma City. And over the years, over my 20 years of handing that book over to people who came in to ask for it, I knew there were inconsistencies in it and maybe some myths and stuff, but it also really needed an update. And so it was really fun, kind of a labor of love. And I, you know, pay homage to Mr. McReel, the original writer and stuff. And it's been a lot of fun talking about that book and signing copies and all kinds of stuff like that. So.
Great. So you've also done some stuff on Oklahoma outlaws, correct?
Yeah, I did a photo essay book on outlaws, but also the lawmen.
So we were looking through, well, actually I asked you suggestions, like we really wanted to do something on Oklahoma outlaws and I didn't know who to pick or if we were going to do like several different ones. And then you had brought up Al Jennings and I had never heard of him. I don't know how I missed him.
I think Al Jennings would be appalled that you'd never heard of
him. I think so. After reading about him, he would definitely be appalled. But He was a really colorful character, and I thought, wow, we could do an entire episode just on Al Jennings. So what was it that stood out for you? Like, why did you even suggest Al Jennings?
Well, yeah, like you said, Al Jennings is really colorful, and when you sort of first encounter him or read about him, a lot of people have the tendency, sort of like the Marshall Tillman did, that this guy's a clown, you know, he's just a self-promoter, and you know, he's delusional and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's real easy to dismiss him that way. And I mean, those are legitimate assessments of him. But I don't know. I was always kind of fascinated by him in some respects because he's sort of the embodiment of what Oklahoma was at the time, which was a land of opportunity, a land of second chances, place where you could reinvent yourself or invent yourself. You know, there were a lot of individualists there that did the kind of things that he did. And I mean, to be honest, just even, I know there's a lot of myth, self-created myth behind his story, but just the factual things were the wide variety of things that he did in his life.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't think I know anybody who led quite the life he did.
Right,
you know,
right. So when did his family moved here from, was it Virginia?
He was born in Virginia and had gone to Ohio. I think his area had been destroyed from the Civil War, and so he went to live with family in Ohio. So he sort of grew up going back and forth between Ohio and Virginia.
And then he comes to El Reno.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's that area is a little bit sketchy. Like, I've never really gotten most of the sources on him. You really have to double check, but I've never really filled in the blank between there. According to him, he was a cowboy, you know, through Kansas and Texas and Oklahoma. And then he ends up in El Reno. No particular reason.
Is he practicing? He practices law, which is practicing law in Indian Territory has got to be different. I mean, there's no bar association. I mean, can you just read a bunch of books and say I'm practicing?
It's exactly. They called it reading the law. Yeah. And his dad was a judge. So I'm sure that he either got some help there or, you know, just had grown up with it.
Right.
And so he ended up being an attorney and really comes into his own in Woodward in the early 1890s.
But he's not alone. He's got his brothers with him.
That's right.
Yeah. And so that's really kind of where the story really starts, is with his two brothers and the shootout with Temple Houston, which is also another pretty big name here in this area. The story fascinates me, too, because, you know, I always think of that the Wild West was so just a romanticized version, but this really is a good example of it really kind of was a Wild West.
Yeah.
I mean, attorneys in shootouts and then...
Well, carrying guns into the courthouse.
Right.
I mean, or into court sessions.
So is there any documentation on why his brothers got into a shootout with Temple Houston?
From what I've been able to put together, and I've heard it from enough places, it's probably true, is it was a simple courtroom rivalry.
Mm-hmm.
His brother Ed and his brother Frank also practiced law in Woodward. And I believe it was Ed had gotten into a court case with Temple Houston. And Temple Houston was, I mean, he's a character all on his own.
Yeah.
He's son of Sam Houston from Texas. He's kind of known to be a bit unhinged and violent. And they had gotten into a court case, and I think Temple Houston accused Ed of being a liar and back and forth. And so they just had this bad blood from courtroom rivalry. And from what I can put together is that the Jennings boys were in the bar drinking after court, and Temple Houston walks in, words were exchanged, and he just shoots them. I don't think I would even call it a shootout.
Yeah, yeah. He just came in and shot him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Almost an assassination attempt.
Exactly.
It sounds like.
Yeah. Ed was killed immediately, and Frank was severely wounded, but did not die of his wounds.
Right.
So. Temple Houston, he just mortally wounded one person, killed another. He's going to jail, right?
Yeah. He did face trial over the murder or the killing, I should say. They determined it wasn't murder, but self-defense. And Temple got off an acquittal, didn't have to serve any time or any sort of punishment from the bar or, you know, whatever it was at the time, you know, went right back into his practice. And I think that is what transformed Al, was that he sort of, it flipped a switch in him that the law was a farce, and that what he was doing was empty, and that he was just, you know, a not very good player in a game, you know. And I think that's what set him against, because that's the recurring theme through all of his writings and movies and everything else that he did, even his political campaigns, was that the law was corrupt.
Did he just directly after this say, hey, I'm going to start robbing trains? Or like, what was the lead up to that?
Actually, from what I can tell is he and once Frank was healed, he and Frank went on a manhunt for Temple Houston. Not real sure why Temple would have been hard to find, but they were out to get him. And everybody in Oklahoma Territory knew, you know, they were out to get him. And they'd finally tracked him to Guthrie, and Temple left town earlier that day, and they turned it into this, like, a story that he'd left in fear of the Jennings, Jennings boys. And they just kind of dropped it after that. I'm not sure why, but then that's when they decided to, you know, hit the bandit trail.
This idea of being an outlaw was nothing. I mean, it existed all around them.
Right, right. Yeah. And actually, when I wrote the book I wrote on Outlaws of the Old West, I identified like two or three strands of the types of outlaw. And one of them was that person who had suffered an injustice at the hands of the law or the government, and they just go on this futile campaign. I mean, they're never going to win, but they, you know, that all-consuming lust to destroy everything around them, you know. And you could say that was what was behind Jesse James, you know, or John Wesley Hardin for sure. People like that were some of the worst bandits and criminals. I think Butch Cassidy, you could say that about too. He was, according to him, falsely accused of cattle rustling, and you know, that's when he went on his train robbing career. Mm-hmm. You know, even said if they just pay me to quit robbing them, I'd quit robbing them. So, you know, but I think Al Jennings would probably fit in that category where he sort of felt like he didn't have any options left. And we find out later, you know, he's a bit of a I don't want to call him a megalomaniac, but, you know, he loves his own story, you know, and mm-hmm. I guess he's sort of writing his story as he goes, you know. Again, like I said at the beginning, I mean, this is Oklahoma's a place you can do that. Can't really do that. And I suppose you could do it in New York or something, but it doesn't have the romance, you know, of, right. of robbing and trains and stagecoaches.
You're much more likely to get picked up by the law. If
exactly.
You're
in or a rival gang yeah. in New York. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they had an actual, I read somewhere it was like the Jennings gang. Was it really the Jennings gang or is that just somebody labeling that or?
Well, that, yeah, I think there were a group of guys. It was Frank and Al, Little Dick West and a couple of other, I think there were two sets of other brothers that were with them. I think that the real mythology, if you want, behind them came from Marshal E.D. Nix, who wrote Oklahombres in the 1920s. He was the marshal for Oklahoma Territory, and he had his deputies were like Bill Tillman, Heck Thomas, Chris Madsen, those famous guardsmen, I think they mm-hmm. called them. And he was people don't realize, but the marshal is actually like a clerk job. It's the deputies that go out and have the shootouts and round up the things. And so, but Nix wrote this book that, oh, I did this and I broke up this gang. So it was to his benefit to turn them into this.
To an actual gang
of, of banditos and all this stuff, you know. So I think that's where the idea came from. I mean, I think they were pretty loosely organized, except mm-hmm. for Al and Frank, obviously being brothers. So, and they mainly operated in, it's weird, they hid out in Indian Territory, but most of their, if you want to call them successes, were in Oklahoma Territory.
So, yeah, so let's talk about their successes, because I think I read somewhere that, was it his second heist, that he actually ended up just with like a bunch of bananas and some whiskey or something?
Yeah. When they were in Indian Territory originally, they would rob stores, and I think they tried a couple banks, but they never got more than $30 or $40 or whatever, and that's why they moved to trains. That's where the real money was. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think the first one they stopped, they got something like, you know, $20 or $30, and they got some food because they'd been hungry because they didn't have any money, you know. And then their first sort of success was they robbed the Santa Fe train leaving Edmond. It was about 3 miles, I think, is the newspaper said, about 3 miles south of Edmond, which I guess is like Memorial.
And, yeah.
yeah. Memorial and Broadway or something. And they'd hidden in this empty baggage car and walked across the top and stopped the train, and there was nothing in it. And, you know, I mean, again, like I said, just a few bucks. And they didn't think to rob the passengers.
Interesting.
Well, he had some sort of code that he went by, right, correct? Like he wasn't ruthless.
Right. He was a Robin Hood or whatever.
And I think I read, but he didn't rob women or preachers.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then they, you know, they hid out after that. The next one I always thought was kind of funny, because they went over to Indian Territory, and somewhere in the Muskogee vicinity, a Katy train was headed down the line, and they stacked up a bunch of railroad ties and lumber and stuff to block the track, and the engineer just stoked the engine and just plowed right through it.
Didn't
and they
even,
just
yeah.
stood there by the side watching the train go by, you know. So,
well, that didn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
So I kind of think of Al Jennings as an unsuccessful Walter White.
You know, there you go.
He broke bad, but wasn't very
good
great at
breaking.
It.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he does, though, eventually get caught.
That's right. Yeah, after the Chickasha train robbery, I think that was a Rock Island train, if I'm not mistaken, but they figured out after they realized that they were having trouble stopping these trains, they got a signalman, held a gun on him, and got him to stop the train. And so they jumped on board, and they were going to blow up the safe that was in the baggage car. Mm-hmm. They had 3 sticks of dynamite, and Little Dick West was the one who was going to blow the safe. And he left 2 of the sticks laying on the ground. He was going to use those as backups. And so they exploded the entire train car, but the safe was left intact, and they couldn't get in the safe. I mean, it's just classic, you know. Apparently, the newspaper said it was splintered, like it was that big of an explosion.
Man.
Yeah. And then so they finally resort to like, well, we have to go ahead and rob the passengers because, you know, we got to get something out of this.
Yeah.
And I think they did get like $300 out of that one, you know. And that's when the deputies took notice, and they took out after they ran to like Tecumseh area, I mm-hmm. think, and the marshals caught up with them. I think it's maybe a 2 or 3 week manhunt and
found them and arrested.
Yeah, they said it was pretty easy, the trails and all that kind of stuff.
So it wasn't exactly a shootout. It was more of a I'm tired of running.
Right, right.
This
yeah,
kinda, I think this is probably like if Corey and I had a gang, this is probably kind of yeah. how it would go. Just a lot of mishaps. What I found really interesting was that he was eventually pardoned by President Theodore Roosevelt. How did that come about? Like, what happened there?
Even before that, his sentence was commuted by McKinley.
Okay.
So it was shortened to, like, I think 2 years. He actually got convicted of life in prison for that because there were U.S. mails in there, and that made it a federal crime, and uh-huh. the punishment for robbing the U.S. mail was life in prison.
Wow.
So he was in Leavenworth and then in a federal pen in Ohio. From what I understand, I think his father, there was some benefactor that was connected with the Republican Party, and mm-hmm. it was just sort of a patronage thing. That was really common then. When presidents, like, you know, when Obama left recently, mm-hmm. they pardoned a bunch of people.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Well, in those days, it was kind of a patronage thing that you were dealing out favors that way. Mm-hmm. And so McKinley shortened his sentence. And then the thing about that is that he still couldn't, you know, like practice law or do anything. So when Roosevelt gave him the full pardon, then he got his full citizenship and everything restored. And so he could practice law.
Yeah, he could practice
law if he wanted to. So was the Roosevelt pardon, was that a patronage thing? Or was that like, I just picture Teddy's love of the Old West and kind of freeing this?
I'm pretty sure it was patronage. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I that's one area I didn't really, that's the kind of thing that it was, when I read that, it was just so common to me that I didn't think twice about it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, that was something that just really stuck out to me because I was thinking like, how did this one dude get pardoned by the president?
And, you know, when you think about it, I mean, he wasn't really that dangerous. I mean, he's more dangerous than me, but he didn't, you know, he didn't kill anybody.
And,
The contemporary write-ups on him in the press, you mentioned the marshal kind of hyping it up, but were the newspapers hyping up his deeds, or was he kind of like a comedic figure?
I don't know that he was comedic then, but I have always noticed that they didn't call him the notorious bad man or, you know, the gunslinger or anything like that. Maybe because he's just kind of unknown, really. Mm-hmm. He didn't have the reputation of like a Jesse James or something. And that's saying something for the newspapers of that era. I mean, they certainly didn't make light of it, and it was front page news for that 2 or 3 weeks that they were hunting him. You know, I think now they don't really report on investigations, but they'd be like, they found the trail and they're headed to Tecumseh. You know, like to me, that's like, hey, get out of town, you know.
Right.
But so, you know, they did have regular updates on the manhunt and stuff like that, but they didn't really, it was really Nix and then he himself that, actually, before Oklahombres came out, Jennings went on his own self-promotional tour. When he was in prison, he met O. Henry, the mm-hmm. famous short story writer. And depending on who you read, even I've looked in some O. Henry biographies, and they sort of riff off each other with their stories. And apparently, Jennings wrote a couple of the stories that got into O. Henry's compendium and stuff like that. And so they sort of influence each other depending on who you read. And so I think that's where Jennings really crafted the self-promotion thing.
Yeah. Building up himself in his own story.
Right.
So he does eventually even write an autobiography, right?
Depending on who you talk to, it's either a novel or an autobiography.
Okay. Yes. And that's what, Beating Back?
Beating Back. Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm not even sure what that means, but yeah.
Yeah. So is this before he goes to Hollywood?
Yeah. Well, it's sort of... Yes, it's before he goes to Hollywood, but it coincides with his beginning in the film industry.
Okay.
Because he wrote the book in like 1913, and uh-huh. by 1914, he's got a film version of it. I mean, this is when, you know, Hollywood was really, movies were, you know, more than one reel, and mm-hmm. you know, you had actual theaters and...
But this is early silent film.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. I think so what he did was got the film made, and there was a big interest in the West then because the West was dying by then. Mm-hmm. It was being kind of romanticized. You know, there weren't, the outlaws and the lawmen were still around, but they were like in their 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And so there was this renewed romanticism around it. And so he made this movie also called Beating Back, and then he would travel with it. He would show it in, you know, whatever town and then give a lecture about it. And there were always these lectures about, you know, going, you know, the sins of that he did and how he's atoning and, you know, this. So he's like just showing you this movie
like an
so you won't do that.
Or?
Yeah, exactly.
Like
yeah,
evangelist mixed with an indie film circuit.
Exactly. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, maybe he's onto something.
Yeah.
So, okay. So he does this film thing and the book and goes on the tour. And then he decides to run for governor of Oklahoma?
He does. He actually had gotten his toe in the political waters a bit earlier. He was actually the county prosecutor for Canadian County.
Okay.
And he went back to El Reno mm-hmm. in the, you know, like 1910, 1911, okay. something like that. And he ran for, well, we would call it DA today, but Oklahoma County, I think it was called Oklahoma County Attorney. Mm-hmm. He ran for that in like 1912. And didn't get elected. And then in 14, he runs for governor. And he campaigns on the, you know, yeah, I broke the law, but I did my time, which he kind of didn't really. But I've learned from my mistakes, and I'm not corrupt like these guys that are running against
right.
me.
Right. I've,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah.
I've made my apologies. I've done my time. I've
right.
atoned for my sins. So
right.
you can trust me now.
Yeah. I'm the honest, dishonest guy. Yeah.
Okay, so he runs for governor, and then obviously he's not elected. But how did he fare? Did he do all right in the election?
He came in third, but he actually did pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, considering, you would kind of hope that he would not get any votes, but you know, he did a pretty good showing considering, you know. and he was up against an incumbent governor and the guy who would be the next governor after that, so Robertson and Williams. So they were pretty big Democratic Party, mm-hmm. you know, guys. And so, yeah, he was never going to win anyway. But, yeah, he did pretty good considering.
Imagine him tapping into kind of this populist ideal of...
That's exactly right.
What did he do after he ran for governor? So he doesn't win the election, and does he just shut up a shop and move, or does he stay here for a while? Or?
Yeah, that's about the time he goes to Hollywood. Like I said, the after Birth of a Nation in 1915, mm-hmm. it was like, okay, this movie thing is going to...
It might actually
yeah.
catch on a little
right,
bit. Yeah.
Right, right. So he, and there, and like I said, there was a really big interest in Western movies. And you, I mean, we all know the sort of classic tropes. I mean, this is when those stuntmen were mm-hmm. just, you know, killing themselves, like jumping on horses from the roof and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And he was a film consultant.
Okay.
And so this is when he moves into this sort of Baron von Munchausen phase where he's just creating his life.
Right, creating story. His own legend.
Yeah, yeah, as he goes.
Yeah, and Hollywood at that time is a place where you can start over.
Right.
And you've
right.
got this, look, all these articles, I'm this notorious outlaw,
right.
and you can be as notorious as you want
right.
to say you
and
were.
if anybody had the wherewithal to check, yeah, he was in federal prison, we got the right,
yeah.
you know. I mean, you know, it's just, he's filling in the blanks around it, you know. And so he, from what I can tell, I don't think he really ever wrote scripts or anything, but you know, he was this expert marksman and horseman, and you know, he would give them the advice on the set and all that. And he was kind of a, you know, B or C lister in Hollywood for several years, like through the 20s, 30s, and 40s, even. So he created more and more stories. His stories got better as he went along. So.
So then was it in the 50s that they actually do an actual movie about him? Was he? Did he have any part with that? Did he consult on
so.
Any of that?
Or? Yeah, I think so. Dan Dorea played mm-hmm. him, you know, consulted with Jennings. I don't know enough about that. That'd be something interesting to read and see mm-hmm. if we could figure out, you know, how much Dorea listened to him, because they weren't doing method acting back then.
Right.
So, you know, you just sort of acted what the director told you, you know.
Yeah, and, yeah. I think I also read that he got upset with the TV show The Lone Ranger for portraying him incorrectly.
That was one of his great coups, because he sued them for making him seem worse than he was.
Okay.
Which was essentially what he has done his whole life, was making
right,
himself seem
right.
way worse than he was. And so, but really what that did was give him a chance to, under oath, tell all his stories.
Oh.
And apparently no one fact-checked or anything. Uh-huh. And so he would, in court, just told his, mm-hmm. you know, like, I wasn't that bad. Let me tell you why. And he would tell his exploits.
And then it's a public record.
It's yeah.
Just
it's
a brilliant self-promoter.
So yeah. What do you call that? Lone Ranger libel?
Yeah.
So he eventually just retires and... Is he married at this point? Or?
He actually was married to his wife for over 50 years.
Oh, yeah. Wow. So they're married.
Apparently not a womanizer from what we can tell, mm-hmm. you know. It was seemed to be the love. In fact, it was sort of that classic thing you hear where he died, you know, just a week or two after she died. Lived to be like 97 or 8, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. And his last great triumph was in maybe the early 50s when there were – I don't know if you've ever heard this, but there were several, sort of like we do with Elvis now, there were all these people that were claiming to be Jesse James. So this was in like, I can't remember the year, maybe 48, 49, something like that. This guy comes forward and says he's Jesse James. And so people are like, well, how can we prove this is him, you know? And they wanted to believe it, you know, and all that. But Al Jennings was like, oh, I knew Jesse James. I can, you know. I mean, the thing was, Al Jennings was like 15 when Jesse James was killed. He might have been older than that, but he did not know Jesse James.
Right. He was in Ohio or Virginia or something at that time.
And they put them together in the same room. They're like, and he's like, Al Jennings is like, Jesse, do you know me? And Jesse James is the guy who claimed to be, oh, yes, I remember. And he just would recount Al's stories back. So that proved that
it was the real Jesse James.
And Al, you know, swore, this is him, boys. You know, this is the guy. And even though Jesse James would have been like 109 or something, you know, I guess it's possible.
But. I think that's the second ending, the alternative cut of the ending of Young Guns 2.
That's right.
Yeah. Corey, what did you ask for Christmas this year?
I asked for a SNES Classic.
What is that?
That is a Super Nintendo Classic. It's these little versions of, you see my little Nintendo over there?
Mm-hmm.
That's that's what I asked for. It's the sequel to that one.
So why do you need a sequel?
Well, I mean,
is this one old now? You just got that one.
I know, but that's the Nintendo Entertainment System. Replica, the little small one.
Right.
The SNES is a replica of the Super Nintendo.
There's a difference between a Super Nintendo and the Nintendo?
Yeah. That was the sequel.
This one's the sequel or the one no, you're getting
the
one, is
the
sequel?
The one I want is the sequel, but it's very hard to find, so I'm not sure if I'll get it. There was a Nintendo, and then there was a Super Nintendo. And then there was a GameCube.
And so
and
now
then
you
there
have
a N64. There's
re-released version of the Nintendo, and you asked for... The re-release of the Super Nintendo. Is that what you're saying?
They're actually kind of small emulators because they don't actually take cartridges. Anyways, I'm a nerd. You know this? I love video games.
Emulator.
What did you ask for Christmas?
I guess not much. A couple of albums and...
That Bowie box that you had your eye on?
No, I didn't get greedy. I just...
Why? It's only like $300, $400,
right? Yeah, I know.
Was it his early years? What was it?
Yeah, it's the Bowie early years. A couple of cookbooks.
Cookbooks?
Yeah, I like to actually hold the book and look through. I kind of like to read them, like a real book.
Okay.
And there is the Vincent Price. I don't know if you know this. Vincent Price and his wife used to do a lot of cooking and throw parties. And so there's a Vincent Price.
Are they all like spooky themed?
No. He was like really into like for serious cooking. So
it's not like
they did a reissue.
Ghastly spaghetti.
No, it's not like goulash or something like that. No, it's actual like real cuisine.
So do you have any traditions?
No.
No holiday traditions?
Not really.
What about the morning of? Do you open gifts the morning of or Christmas Eve?
It just depends on people's schedules.
We open up gifts on Christmas Eve except for one. But that was when I was little. Like when I got my original Nintendo, my original laser tag.
Mm-hmm.
You'd get that open gift. Christmas Day was that was what
so
Santa,
like the
Santa
big
brought.
One. Oh, okay.
The big one, yeah, the big one. But you opened up all the other gifts Christmas Eve.
See, we did a little bit Christmas Eve and then everything else on Christmas Day. But that was when I was a kid. Dave and I don't really have any traditions.
You should start some. We're starting one where we make breakfast casserole. and watch Charlie Brown's Christmas special.
You know, it's probably different with a kid, I'm guessing. Like, my dogs just really aren't going to appreciate
it. Alex is almost three, so this will be probably the first Christmas she actually remembers.
She's, like, going to realize, like...
Yeah, she's very excited about Santa.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Think of a tradition. We'll think of one. Maybe you...
Well, we do go to the bar every Christmas Eve.
I think... Yeah, if I didn't have a kid, I'd be at the bar, yeah. too.
But I didn't really want to say that was a tradition, so I mean...
Well, we're not going to have another episode for a full month. We're going to take a
little break, yeah.
Get our ducks in a row, mm-hmm. Get our brains unscrambled from the holiday.
It's true. I have to admit, I kind of have holiday, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what you call it, but...
Itis?
Holiday-itis.
I think it's also called depression. Yeah, we'll get through this together. Christmas time is here.
Yeah, that's like the most depressing Christmas song ever.
That album is so good, though. I've been popping it on. Doom, boom, boom, boom. It's got the upbeat, little kind of dance numbers.
Do you do the Charlie Brown dance?
So we'll talk to you in a month. We have no idea what our next topic is.
We don't. We're just going to kind of regroup and think about, like, what do we want to do?
Yeah, thanks, everyone, for listening and putting up with our jibber-jabber. If you like what you hear, write us a review on iTunes. That really helps us out a lot.
It does. And we'll still be, over the next couple of weeks, we'll still be posting stuff on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. So
yeah, so check out those places. And
might do like maybe a holiday music list, a playlist or something. That'd be fun.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, let's do that.
Happy holidays, and we'll see you guys in a month.